Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It's Monday, April 29th. A federal trial seeking damages for some 7,000 families harmed by fuel-contaminated drinking water is underway this morning. The lawsuit seeks compensation from the military for their admitted negligence that led to the fuel spill at its Red Hill underground facility 2.5 years ago. We hear more about the Navy's explanation and theory that lab contamination led to false positives in water samples taken earlier this year, one of two reports released almost on the eve of trial. The governor's trying to save a bill tied to Hawaiian Electric's future. Some worry that without it, the utility could go bankrupt. Lots of last-minute wrangling to get it passed out before the end of session this week. And as we come off Wildlife Week, we catch up with the lone bird to survive a relocation on Maui. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A crowd of sign waivers gathered at the front of federal court early this morning. Members of the Oahu Water Protectors and the Sierra Club Hawaii rallied to support families who sued the military after fuel-contaminated drinking water affected them 2.5 years ago. Christina Baer represents thousands of families and civilians who joined in the legal action against the military for damages. She spoke before heading into court, saying this was a case about the government abandoning its people and how residents of Hawaii supported those affected families.
When the government turned its back, the people of Hawaii were there, chanting for the land, embracing them with aloha, delivering water, sharing their stories. And so collectively, they rose up and they prevailed. They prevailed in shutting down Red Hill. It's ongoing. It's going to be a process. It's not like it's all over. But they also prevailed in this case where they basically forced the government to admit liability in what is the first successful mass environmental case against the United States. Liability has been established. That means that the government has admitted that it contaminated the water. The government calls it contaminating. The people behind me call it poisoning. That has been established. And now we go forth to prove the extent of the harm. Mahalo.
And this weekend, the issue got national coverage on the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes. The crew was here filming in the fall and interviewed Assistant Secretary of the Navy Meredith Berger, as well as other officials and military families, and the Board of Water Supply Chief Engineer Ernie Lau. Here's a clip from the segment.
2,000 military families agree the Navy didn't go far enough and are suing the government. The Traegers and Dietzes have joined the lawsuit, alleging they were harmed by negligence at Red Hill.
Are you angry that it happened, or are you angry at what happened after?
It's a little bit of anger, but it's also this feeling of betrayal.
What do you mean betrayal?
So my husband has been in for almost 18 years. We have moved our family cross country, cross oceans. We gave so much of our life to the Navy for them to ignore warnings, and then we were directly and blatantly lied to about it.
Navy leadership has apologized for the spill, but has not said that the contaminated water is the cause of the ongoing illnesses. The Navy did set up a clinic on base to collect data and treat anyone who believes they have health issues related to the tainted water.
What happens in 5 or 10 or 15 years? Will those services still be available to these families?
So that is part of why we are making sure that we're collecting that information to inform future actions and what the requirements are for those types of needs and care.
That doesn't sound like a guarantee of care in the future.
And I want to be careful because I don't do the healthcare part of things, and so I don't want to speak outside of where I have any authority or decision.
So we followed up with the Defense Department, which told us it's reviewing the question of long-term healthcare for military families, including more than 3,100 children. 2 years after the spill, some residents have reported water with a smell or sheen. The Navy is conducting daily tests at Pearl Harbor and says it is confident there is no fuel in the tap water. Rochelle Dietz is still using bottled water. The lawsuit she joined with Brittany Traeger and the other military families is scheduled to go to trial tomorrow.
What is the remedy that you want? In our family, it's restoring my faith in our nation.
That's a big thing to say.
There's a body of government that failed. They contaminated our water. They lied to us. They did not protect us, and they did not intervene. And accountability looks like a lifelong care plan for me, my family, and the people affected. And that will restore my faith in my nation.
Members of the Oahu Water Protectors in Sierra Club, Hawaii, gathered with those affected families outside that courthouse today. Marty Townsend is the former head of the Sierra Club. She also chairs a group, the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative. She expressed her skepticism of the timing of the release of two reports by the Navy late last week. They were related to the 2021 spill and the recent reports of possible ongoing water contamination that the Navy believes are false positives due to the reaction of chlorine in the water. Here's Townsend.
It's just a coincidence that they put all of this effort into dropping these huge reports, you know, a few days before trial begins and, you know, trying to, you know, sway public opinion against the victims. I mean, I wish they spent as much effort trying to solve the problem as they spent on trying to deny it, you know? It's outrageous that at this point, with how much documentation we have of the harm that people have suffered, that the Navy is still taking the position that it's mostly in people's heads. Like, that's just deeply offensive and outrageous. And it goes to show they haven't learned their lesson.
The other report that talked about the samples, the false positives.
Oh, yes, the 8,000 samples, right? Are they valid? Are they not? We don't know. I think the Navy has done a really good job of casting enough doubt on their own sampling that if we do get high, you know, reports of contamination, they can, you know, explain it away, which I think is part of the reason why they did that. And so they count these 8,000 samples as valid. I think they're suspect. That said, it's what we have to work with, and so we should, you know, we should use that information to the extent that we can, and know that the Navy knew from, you know, early on after the November 2021 disaster that chlorine was an issue in taking these samples, and for 2 years they did not use this other test that exists, slightly more expensive, that could have given us more accurate results, more accurate analysis. And they chose instead to go with this other test that they are using now. It doesn't account for the chlorine and allows for there to be doubt as to what these samples, what the analysis actually shows us.
When we talked to the Board of Water Supply, they said that, well, you know, we haven't had any issues with the chlorination with their water.
Yeah, I think because the Board of Water Supply is using a proper test, right? The Board of Water Supply is actually interested in getting down to the root causes of these problems in the water. And so they are, you know, they're being good stewards of the resource. And we just haven't seen that from the Navy at any level at any time.
But the Navy maintains it, too, is trying to get to the root cause of the high levels of TPH, or total petroleum hydrocarbons. We heard from a Navy dependent, Lacey Quintero, this morning. She was glad that the families finally get their day in court.
This feels monumental. I don't know really what's going to be said. Obviously, there's a lot of stress coming here, potentially having to hear people continue to gaslight us. I'm very worried about that. I hope the truth is said. I hope that people are brave and they speak truth for everything that we've all gone through collectively as an impacted community. I'm obviously here just one person, but I hope that some of our signs and are representing those that couldn't make it today, that had to move off the island.
There was a segment on national TV this weekend, 60 Minutes. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. I wish that the 60 Minutes would have covered, you know, the civilian families that were impacted. It didn't even mention them. They received no support from the military. They didn't get moved out of their apartments. They didn't get water handed out to them. They did not get anything. They couldn't even attend the town halls because they were located on base. They were completely shut out. And there was no mention of that. And it also downplayed the amount of people who were actually affected.
And we will have more coverage related to the Red Hill water contamination trial that started today right after this break.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Virtual open house Sunday, May 5th. More by searching OLLIUHM.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jude Currivan, author of The Cosmic Hologram, Information at the Center of Creation. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the unified nature of reality.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the Kamauela Philharmonic on Hawaii Island, performing Pop's classics from Broadway and the silver screen, Sunday, May 5th at Kahilu Theater in Waimea. Tickets at kamauelaphil.org.
You know, as we heard earlier, the military released two reports related to Red Hill last week. One included a health survey documenting how many people reported ill effects from the drinking water contamination. The second was a report pointing to false positives in the lab. Chris Waldron is a contractor with the Swarm Team, a group of experts tasked with responding to the recent complaints about continuing sheens and odors from their tap water. Here's Waldron explaining their theory.
The Navy collected, as part of the tech memo, 658 samples where we collected side by side. So we used the original method that was performed during the long-term monitoring period that resulted in the false positive detections. We collected a sample for that, and at the same time, we collected a sample using the method that was recommended by the Swarm Team. We called microextraction, and we sent those samples off to the lab. We did not detect TPH in any of the microextraction samples. And the microextraction samples account for the chlorine interaction.
And so this leads you to believe that there is no jet fuel in the water.
Yes. The result of the work that was done by the Swarm Team, we evaluated multiple lines of evidence. The side-by-side sampling is one of those lines of evidence, and they're documented in detail. I mean, the tech memo report's well over 400 pages long. It's very technical. It addresses a lot of things, but we're confident in the results of the evaluation that the low-level TPH detections observed during LTM are associated with false positives due to the interaction of chlorine in the samples.
Well, I have to ask you, because when we talked with the officials from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, they were saying, you know, they have chlorination in their water as well, in the drinking water that supplies most Oahu, but they've never really had any issues with the TPH numbers.
Now, I can't speak directly to the Board of Water Supply. I haven't had an opportunity to look at their data, but the results that we've evaluated have been looked at by the EPA and the DOH. We've been working with them and sharing information on a daily and weekly basis with respect to all of the information that the Swarm Team pulled together. I believe that there was a comment from EPA that they generally agree with the findings, the primary findings of the false positives as it relates to chlorine in the samples. So I think that's the important point. The report was really a team effort. There were over 20 experts involved in the development of the report. It was a comprehensive evaluation of water quality and trying to evaluate the root causes of the TPH detections. And so that just a really experienced group, people, you know, with backgrounds in drinking water and drinking water systems, engineers, chemists, biologists, toxicologists, risk assessors, and so on, put in a lot of really, really, you know, good work, hard work, dug into this, and that culminated in the report that went out. And the report is highly technical. It's a technical document. It's going to take some time for folks to kind of get through that. I'm hoping it'll facilitate, you know, our discussions back and forth with EPA as they were part of the process and participated in the calls, as well as DOH. you know, we talked with them in many instances daily, but we've continued to kind of discuss where we are and what our findings are, and so hopefully that'll facilitate their review, but I understand it's going to take them a little bit of time to get through the entire document. But the main thing, obviously, is, you know, shared with them previously what we saw as the root cause of being, you know, the chlorine interaction, and the comment from EPA was that they generally concurred with that as the finding and as explaining the kind of the false positive TPH detections, and that's one of the most important components of this.
The way I understand it, that there was no real test for drinking water, that you folks were using a test for groundwater, and that the TPH, the compounds, could come from either fuel or could be organic. And I know that you folks have committed to another year of monitoring. The military has committed to that. And you are meeting daily, and you're still sampling.
Yeah, that's correct. So the method, as you mentioned, is what we call method 8015, but it's a non-drinking water method. We were required to use that method as part of this process. I mean, the data from that method are valid. I want to emphasize that. You know, we collected nearly 9,000 samples as part of the long-term monitoring program. One of the findings from the SWARM team work is that, you know, likely what we're really seeing is an overestimate in the TPH concentration. So the method results in, you know, a false positive at low levels, and so that data is still valid. It still can be used to help us to inform decision making. You just need to dig into it. When we see a result, low level detect, we need to dig deeper and to figure out, is this actually petroleum, or is this potentially something from a biological process, because those can be detected? Is it an interference with chlorine? In addition to that, as you mentioned, just want to emphasize is that the Navy is committed to the safety and well-being of everybody on the system. And as part of that commitment, the Navy is continuing to monitor the system for at least another year. As part of that, we've got what we call the Extended Drinking Water Monitoring Program. That program has incorporated the recommendations of the SWARM team into the sampling effort, which is really important. Secondly, we've also got what's called the Water Quality Action Team. That's a new enhanced team that will go out to locations where we have questions, concerns from users on the systems about their water quality. That team will go out, do the inspections. They will do a very detailed evaluation of the water system at the house, including the water tank and pipes, and collect some other field samples in order to take a broad look at the overall water quality. And then, you know, the other things we're doing is we're continuing to do the medical monitoring component of this, which is very important so that folks with health concerns can reach out to their medical provider. And we're doing the routine compliance monitoring that's part of operating the systems. You know, you kind of look at this as an umbrella in terms of the example of that commitment to the water quality at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam.
And then just to clarify, because I believe earlier this year you did not have a petroleum's expert on this SWARM team. Do you now?
We do have a petroleum expert on the SWARM team. You know, the SWARM team started on January 29th, 2024, and we had chemists and folks that had lots and lots of experience with and were experts with petroleum. So that's been part of this process since the beginning, that there's been folks that are experts with petroleum and analysis of petroleum. So something that's really important for folks to know is that that's always been part of the things that we've done.
And then what do you say to the families that still have great discomfort and they don't trust what you're saying?
Well, we take all of the reports of those suffering illness seriously, and we encourage them to reach out to their medical providers to get the attention that they need. You know, we did this study in order to have a better understanding of the water system. And I think that that's really important. And by understanding what is in the water and what's not in the water, we can now look at other reasons, other potential reasons for those reported illnesses. So that's part of the commitment to the Joint Base community, is to continue to follow through, continue to test, and to continue to evaluate the data.
That was Chris Waldron of the Military SWARM Team. Meanwhile, state health officials are close to wrapping up their independent review on the water complaints filed in recent months. That federal trial over the fuel spill and contaminated water that happened more than 2.5 years ago is now before Judge Leslie Kobayashi and is expected to take about 10 days.
There are more than 5,000 illegal addiction treatment centers in Mexico. Families often send loved ones there against their will.
But also at the same time, a space of care and concern and attention that people may not have gotten that outside.
The rise of informal, illegal addiction care in Mexico and here in the United States. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Skin cancer is the most common type of cancer in the United States, with 10,000 people diagnosed every year in Hawaii alone. Extended sun exposure is a major risk factor. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk about a skin cancer screening van headed your way. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Oahu's North Shore is known worldwide for incredible surf spots, including Pipeline, Waimea Bay, and Sunset Beach. Their fame has often overshadowed the equally impressive North Shore of Maui. During the winter big wave season, Honolulu Bay and Ho'okipa see consistently strong surf to rival any of Oahu's powerhouses. To the east of Ho'okipa is where Maui's true giant resides, though. If you haven't already guessed, we're talking about Jaws. With the power to churn out 50-plus foot waves, Jaws is the furthest thing from a beginner's break. Back in January of 2004, surfer Pete Cabrina brought attention to the spot when he was witness riding a 70-foot monster of a wave. It got its name in the 1970s when some Maui surfers compared the break's unpredictable conditions to the unpredictability of a shark attack. For this morning's backyard quiz, we want you to tell us the other name for Maui's epic surf spot, Jaws. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HBR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Lawmakers worked over the weekend in hopes of resolving key legislative issues in this final week of session. A high priority is a bill that some worry, if it isn't passed, could hasten the bankruptcy of Hawaiian Electric. HBR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pope joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what's the latest?
Yeah, so we're talking about Senate Bill 2922, which has gotten a lot of attention this legislative session, both good and bad. And briefly, what this bill would allow HECO to do is raise money through ratepayer-backed bonds for wildfire mitigation. And we've seen a lot of people come out on both sides on this. Notably, Governor Josh Green has been a huge proponent of this bill. He says that it's critical to HECO's financial health as well as the state's overall energy goals. We've also seen utility analysts who say, as you said at the top, if HECO doesn't have the buffer of being able to raise these funds, then we're more likely going to see HECO, one part of the Hawaiian electric industries, apply for bankruptcy sometime this year. However, opponents on the bill say, hey, you're trying to increase our electric bills, our rates, at a time when many of us are already struggling, and also at a time where there's still a lot of questions we don't know about the causes of the fire and the liability that has put HECO into such a drastic financial position in the first place. So that all kind of came to a head in this legislative session. And as we saw, Senate Jared Keohokalole decided, you know what, there's too many unknowns about this bill at this time. We don't want to subject ratepayers to an increase in this bill. So we're going to table it for now. Okay. So that was the latest. That was the latest update as of Thursday last week.
Right, and then I know the governor sent off a letter saying, "Hey, reconsider."
Basically, he didn't want to see the measure die such an unceremonious death, so he wrote a letter to Keohokalole, urging him and his fellow lawmakers to reconsider passing the measure. And in a statement to HBR on Friday, the governor's office said that they would continue to negotiate with Senate lawmakers over the weekend to see if they could come to some sort of compromise on the bill. And the governor was signaling it was possible the legislature may reconvene today, which as of yet has not happened. And heading into the weekend, when we reached out to Senator Jared Keohokalole, he said he wasn't sure if the governor could offer any new arguments that would change his mind.
We've had at least 5 hearings on this measure. We went at length into HECO's status and these issues in the confirmation of PUC Commissioner Colin Yost, and we held a 3.5-hour informational briefing with HECO and KIUC last week Thursday. So it's unclear to me what other information might be available at this point to affect the decision.
Yeah, so he wants to, just have more, I guess, hard data as to what we're talking about and not just write a blank check?
Right. So where the session is kind of in this awkward middle ground, right, where they've been able to convene in these 4 months in order to try to pass legislation that will help with wildfire recovery and prevention on a number of fronts. But we still don't have a lot more information than we did when the fire happens. So the Attorney General's Office report, an investigation into the fires, is still ongoing. They did release phase one of their report this month, but phase two, which is what's really going to get into the meat of policy recommendations, that's not anticipated until this fall, so ahead of the session 2025. And then the report that's coming out of Maui County with ATF, that's going to tell us definitively, hopefully, what caused the fire, we don't have that yet either. So Keohokalole basically said, you know, we don't have information from those reports to understand the full context of the disaster. We don't want to sign off on language that theoretically could allow HECO to recoup costs related to that fire without knowing what their exact responsibility is for this disaster. And also, one of his main concerns is we don't have a guarantee that securitization by itself will be able to essentially keep HECO afloat. And what if we lose our locally owned utility and then ratepayers are still on the hook for these rates to a different utility, to a large company that should come in and buy out HECO? That's something that has been a big concern among lawmakers this session as well, is if HECO transfers out of locally owned hands.
Yeah, I mean, we saw what happened with the NextEra deal, right? Lots of hand-wringing over those hearings before the PUC about whether or not that was a good or bad thing for Hawaii. And ultimately, you know, I think the governor, at the time, said he didn't think it was. And so the decision, you know, went against NextEra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I spoke with Henry Curtis. He's the executive director of Life of the Land. He follows these issues closely. And he says that there have been a number of different things that have been working against Senate Bill 2922. One of them, as we talked about, is this awkward timing and the many unanswered questions about the Lahaina fire. He said there's also a number of controversial provisions in the bill. One is what we talked about. What exactly can HECO use these funds for? Can they use it just for wildfire mitigation, or can they use it to recoup costs related to the fire? That's something that a lot of people take issue with. There's also the question of how they would submit plans to the Public Utilities Commission about what they're doing about wildfires. Some of the language of this bill allows them to do that through kind of a closed-door process. But beyond that, Curtis says that utility financing is just a really complicated topic. And he said there were a lot of misconceptions among the public about this bill, as well as how this bill was portrayed by the media. And he thinks lawmakers did the best that they could in trying to parse through this really difficult issue, but there's just a lot to cover.
Yeah, it's complicated. It is very complicated, but oh my gosh, so much writing on these bills.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been covering this bill, and at this point, I feel like I'm having dreams about SB 2922. Mm-hmm. And still, every day, there's another element to securitization that I'm learning about. But without this bill, it kind of wonders as what is the legislature going to pass concretely that it makes progress on all the issues that we've been talking about in terms of wildfires. So dozens of bills were introduced at the start of the session, and only a handful have made it through to conference. And some did pass out of their committee, so it looks like there will be a final vote this week on whether or not to establish an office of a state fire marshal, as well as a possible two-year program at the University of Hawaii to develop a wildfire forecast system for the state using artificial intelligence, which is something that I believe you and I talked about on the show a couple months ago. But Henry Curtis worries that the position that we're in right now is not enough of state officials and lawmakers' talk is actually translating into action.
The thing that scares the heck out of Life of the Land is that while we're having all these discussions and debates, another Lahaina happens. There is a million acres of dead grasses every summer. We're heading into the summer season. Fires can erupt everywhere. And it's really critical that we move quickly in looking at how fires are caused, how fires can be minimized when they are lit, and all the different ways of absolutely minimizing any chance that another Lahaina would occur. And therefore, we have to move quickly on looking at options. That's why the Public Utilities Commission needs to open a docket now. And it's why the wildfires symposium that HECO had included AT&T, T-Mobile, Hawaiian Tel, the county wastewater and water companies, and private water companies, because all utilities need to collectively look at how we can move towards a future where fire is not going to destroy communities.
Yeah, I mean, we've had lots of losses, this past year, and we just want to prevent another Lahaina from happening again. But I guess we'll just have to see how this plays out in these remaining days, and if there's some horse trading going on in the background that we don't know about with this particular bill.
Yes, we shall see for sure.
All right. Thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We have been talking to HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can read her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
John Bon Jovi has sung his big anthems in stadiums around the world, but a couple of years ago he stopped performing because of vocal problems. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about the surgery that's enabled him to record again. A Bon Jovi documentary series is streaming on Hulu. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
The history of the credit card begins in department stores.
Retailers and merchants really sought a way to get customers to keep coming back to their shop instead of going to their competitors.
The history of the credit card begins in department stores. I'm Kimberly Adams. Nowadays, credit cards and their fees can have a major effect on a retailer's bottom line. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Now it's time to answer the backyard quiz. Earlier, we took a walk along Maui's North Shore and stopped to look at the surf. Looking is all most of us can do. With spots like Honolulu Bay and Ho'okipa, Maui has a strong lineup that rivals many of Oahu's best surf spots. During big wave season, Maui surf can be consistent and huge. An area lying to the east of Ho'okipa is home to Maui's true powerhouse break, known to locals as Jaws. Behemoth waves there can reach 70-plus feet. Just last year, Maui kite surfer Patry McLaughlin broke the world record for the largest wave ever kite surfed at 72 feet. Since the 1990s, the break has become part of pop culture, and the publicity has led to overcrowding during surf season. For today's backyard quiz, we asked if you knew the other common name for Jaws. If you said Peahi, you're right. Peahi is actually the name of the area where the break is located and means wave in Hawaiian, in the sense of the beckoning motion with the hand. And congrats to our winner, who hails from the island of Hawaii, Bobby Kamara. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one to share, write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member, your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that. Forget all the other concerns and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
It was 5 years ago that 7 endangered Maui parrotbills, known as QEQ, were transported to an East Maui forest. It was in hopes of establishing a new colony. The idea was to protect the birds from malaria-carrying mosquitoes in lower elevations. But the program failed, and all translocated birds were believed to have died. But then, last fall, a report surfaced of the capture of a QEQ named Mapa One, proof of a sole survivor. We talked to Laura Berthold. She's a Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project Avian Field Research Supervisor. We also talked with former avian research tech Zach Pizzillo. He updates us with the story of Mapa One with the conversation's Lillian Song.
When we released him, his transmitter kind of quickly, there's a slight malfunction with it, and we lost track of him. And a couple weeks after the release, I was out doing some routine field work, and I heard a bird above me, and I looked up, and there was Mapa Number One. He was still in the area, but this was only a couple weeks after the initial release. And then after that, he fell off the radar. We didn't see him. We assumed that, like what happened to the rest of the birds, he had succumbed to avian malaria. So yeah, when we were out there in 2021 in July, we had no idea that he was still out there. And then we were just finishing up the trip. It was like our last day out there. We had a big group of volunteers, and we were planting a bunch of native trees. And I'd finished up a little early and hiking back up to the spot where the helicopter had dropped off all the plants for us. And I get up there, and I hear a QEQ call. I didn't really believe it at first. My cell phone text tone is a QEQ calling, so maybe it was that. I heard it again, and I heard it again. So I walk over the edge of the gulch, and sure enough, there's a QEQ singing and calling in there. And I called back, because that was the only thing I could think to do. So I whistled back at it. That's kind of a three-note whistle they often do between each other. And it whistled back, and it sang a couple different times. And I quickly got binoculars, and we were able to get eyes on it and see that it was banded. The color bands did match this bird that we had thought was no longer alive. Yeah, it was incredible. And at that point, the rest of the group, I think there were maybe 9 or 10 of us out there, had all gotten up there, and everybody got to see the bird. It was a very special moment to share that with all these volunteers and a few other people who had been part of the translocation were out there as well, and they got to see him again.
At this point in July 2021, you're still in Nakula,
yes,
the area where the colony was translocated to.
Yes.
So that was 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was actually about a year later we started seeing a male QEQ with the same color combination as MAPA 1. So typically we have on our color banded birds three colors and one metal numbered band. It has a unique number on it, but you can't see the number typically with binoculars. So you have the colors that you can distinguish between individuals. It's a unique color combination. And he only had two colors and the one metal band because he was going to have a transmitter, and we have to make sure that it's not going to be too much weight on his body. So he only had two color bands plus the transmitter and the metal band. And so we started seeing this bird with this color combination. We're like, no way. It cannot be MAPA 1. Like, that's just incredible. And so in my mind, I thought it was a 10-year-old bird who had lost one of its color bands. And, you know, one of my coworkers kept on being like, it's MAPA 1. It's got to be MAPA 1. And I was just like, I don't know. Don't get our hopes up. And then we had about, I guess, a year after that, and we've been trying to catch him and with playback. They're typically very territorial, so we can use playback to bring them into our nets that we use for studying the birds, and he just wouldn't have it. He was very difficult to catch. And so in November last year, we had several nets up in hopes that he would just kind of come on through and we would catch him, and we did. And it was just one of those moments where I couldn't believe it. I just like was holding my breath as I read his number out loud. And the person I read it to was checking our data, and he's like, that's MAPA 1. And it was just this like tears in your eyes. And, you know, everyone was just so emotional that he was still alive and he had made this journey from the other side of the mountain, probably an 8 to 10 mile journey for this tiny bird to come back to his home so that he could find a mate. And he did. He had a mate and he had a hatch year. And we actually, exciting news, we just came out of the field this week and we saw him, and he has another hatch year, and he's still with his mate that he was with last year. So that's pretty exciting.
That's wonderful news. They, as the family unit, as they are teaching the fledgling to become a QEQ in life, it takes time.
It does. So if he had that fledgling this year, that young bird can be dependent to the parents for up to 15 months. So it can be quite a long time that it takes for them to learn how to be a QEQ. Their bills are so unique. They use them to pry open bark, to pull out caterpillars. And so, you know, that little QEQ is going to kind of figure out how to survive out there and find its food, and will be dependent on the parents for a bit of time because they are such specialist species. We did a whole inspection. He looked great and, you know, good fat levels. His feathers looked all healthy. We took a blood sample so that we could confirm whether or not he had avian malaria. And then we released him. And then, of course, you know, had to call everybody that we had found him and, you know, what that meant to everybody personally and what that meant for the hope for the species as well, because his blood sample did come back as positive for malaria. So one out of the 7 birds that we had brought over to Nakula survived malaria. It's not great odds, but, you know, it gives you hope that there are some individuals that are able to survive it.
So that question of whether or not he had avian malaria, that question was answered with that blood sample getting tested. Are there any other questions that the blood sample will answer?
Yeah, so there's actually, I mean, we're partnering with folks at the Smithsonian Institute. They're doing a genetic study to look at exactly what's happening with this potential resistance in Hawaiian honeycreepers. They're, of course, studying, you know, more common species, the Hawaii amakihi, but MAPA1's genetic structure will also help in looking at that question of what traits allow Hawaiian honeycreepers to potentially survive malaria. These birds evolved without mosquitoes and malaria. So, you know, most of the time, any, you know, infection that they get from mosquitoes, it'll be fatal. But there could be certain individuals that are showing these resistance patterns and have certain genetics that are maybe evolving or have always been there and we didn't know about it. And those are the ones that are surviving.
And as the project moves forward, are there protections in place that are helping them with the avian malaria?
Yeah, especially after 2019, like we'd known for a while that mosquitoes and avian malaria were threatening the birds and causing extinctions and declines. But it was something that we thought was happening at lower elevations. And then we had the translocation and we were, you know, nearly at 6,000 feet in elevation and we had mosquitoes and avian malaria. So, you know, with climate change, we're seeing warmer temperatures, drier years. This really makes the mosquitoes able to reproduce and travel up to these higher, typically cooler elevations, especially seasonally, like in the fall when it is, you know, drier and warmer. And so what we are doing and what we've been working on for the last 5 years is trying to come up with a really effective mosquito control technique. And that's using the Wolbachia bacteria, which is a form of birth control to reduce those mosquito populations. And we have been trying out this method since the fall of last year, and we'll be excited to collect all the data that, you know, we need to in order to see if it's effective and how we can make it more of a landscape scale mosquito control that can be, you know, applied throughout the KiwiQ range and some of these other Hawaiian honeycreeper species like the Okohekohe, their ranges, so that we can continue to have these really unique special birds on Maui, in Hawaii, so they can continue on and have more of these generations that we can see and have them a part of the forest ecosystem.
With the mosquito, understanding that there has been some pushback to this birth control method, what is the situation now on Maui? Catch me up on that.
It has at least currently been resolved. You know, of course, want everybody to continue to support these endeavors in trying to reduce mosquito populations. So we appreciate all of the support that we have received and, you know, continue just letting, you know, those that are in legislation that the birds are important, and if we don't do anything about mosquitoes, we will lose them, and that's what we're facing. We're facing extinction.
And just in these last few minutes, Zach, things that you would like to share with our listeners about the project moving forward? Final thoughts here.
Yeah, it was incredible to receive that call from Laura from the field, letting me know that MAPA number one had made it back to his home territory in Hanavinar, and I, you know, it just gives us hope that these birds will, there is some possible resistance to avian malaria that this bird will be able to pass on to its hatchlings and maybe others within the species, and then other species of honeycreepers across Hawaii. It's been incredibly difficult to watch the situation on Kauai with the akikiki just disappearing from the wild and extremely quickly because of avian malaria. But MAPIN number one, QEQ number one, persisting and making this journey and breeding and having, you know, now two additional offspring gives us a bit of hope.
Hope for the species. That was Zach Pizzillo and Laura Berthold of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project with HPR's Lillian Song. In 2021, it was estimated that there were 135 QEQ found in the wild, and MAPL1's resistance to avian malaria has added two more baby Maui parrotbills to the count. We'll share pictures and links on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we hope to get an update on bills in jeopardy as the 2024 legislative session draws to a close later this week. Got a question or want to share your thoughts? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. The conversation is available on our website and as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.